Insights with Business Link London. All the answers you need to help a business grow. Douglas Cameron on LBC 1152.
It's 8 minutes past six. This is generally the time of day when we have a look at tomorrow's news tonight, but we're making a slight departure from the usual pattern tonight because I want to concentrate on a special issue of Time magazine, which has been brought out. It's called The New Age of Discovery, and the editor is James Geary, and James is my guest this evening. James, a very good evening to you.
Good evening.
How many times do we have a special issue of Time magazine?
Well, we're hoping to make it an annual event. It started last year. Last year was the 50th anniversary of Time magazine in Europe, and we did a special commemorative issue, and we had so much fun doing that, and it turned out to be such a success that we decided to repeat it every year. And each year with a different theme, of course, and this year we chose Discovery.
Right. Well, there's so much to talk about, but I picked out half a dozen or so items that we can discuss. The first one is Save the Earth. Now, this is a Skywatch program, isn't it, for rogue asteroids?
That's correct. There's currently a theory going around, which many scientists believe in, that the mass extinctions of the past, the dinosaurs and the extinctions that took place millions of years ago, were actually caused by huge asteroids smashing into Earth. And advances in satellite technology and things like that have actually identified hundreds of thousands of these comets and asteroids coming very, very close, dangerously close to Earth. And there are a group of international astronomers and scientists who are very concerned that what happened several million years ago could happen again very soon.
So it's the giant asteroids or the comets smashing into the Earth we now think. But I suppose previously we thought it was disease, climatic changes, volcanism, this sort of thing.
Exactly. There's geological evidence to suggest that the craters that are left by these comets smashing into Earth correspond roughly to the time at which these extinctions took place.
Mm.
And for example, as recently as 1908, there was, I think it was about 60 meters across, an asteroid that exploded. It didn't even hit the Earth. It exploded above Siberia and devastated an area of, I think, 100,000 or 1,000 square kilometers. Now, if that had happened over a city, you can imagine the devastation that would take place. And that comet exploded in the atmosphere. It didn't even impact on the Earth.
Now, can this ever be proved, this sort of theory?
Well, it can, and the proof would be an actual impact, but I think very few people would want to have that degree of conclusive proof. There is, as I said, there are sky watchers out there now, and there are actually programs in America and also here in Europe and in Asia, I believe, as well, of people who are monitoring the skies for these kind of things. I think just a few years ago, and as I said, thousands of these are identified all the time, some of them coming very, very close to Earth, and the scientists fear that it could get too close for comfort, and they're exploring ways to deal with that.
Well, I'm just reading your article, Save the Earth, here, and it says as recently as 1989, an asteroid 800 meters across, undetected until after it passed, missed the Earth by only a million kilometers or so, a hair's breadth by astronomical standards.
That's right. That would be the equivalent of having a black cab miss you by a few inches if you're walking down the street in central London. And I think that has really put the fear of God, or the fear of asteroids at least, into a lot of scientists. And in the United States at least, they've been petitioning the government to provide funds to develop ways to deal with this, for example, by firing nuclear warheads at the asteroids when they're far enough away to kind of nudge them into a different orbit so that they would miss the Earth.
Well, we don't want to spread alarm, of course, but that was a near miss. There could be a direct hit one day.
Yes, there could be, and you're absolutely right to say we don't want to sow alarm.
No.
And there are, as far as I'm aware, there are no impending catastrophes on the agenda.
Oh, you can see ahead a little bit, can you?
Well, the Skywatch programs that are going on now, they can identify asteroids to at a certain distance. But it's debatable whether it would be far enough to be able to do anything about it if it should prove that it's on a collision course with Earth.
Fascinating stuff. James will continue this after the news break. James Geary is my guest, special guest tonight, editor of the special Discovery edition of Time magazine. It's 13 minutes past six.
The time has come, my love. We have to say goodbye. I will never forget your rich, beautiful perfume, your perfectly formed body, all the pain. I must be mad to let you go. And to him, of all people, that Roujard, go now and don't look back.
Dear Jean, happy birthday, mon ami.
Oh, Jean-Luc, a bottle of Le Plat d'Or. You shouldn't have.
You're quite right, Jean.
Ah, dis donc, it's mine.
Le Plat d'Or, from Piat Wines, the other great French passion.
To attract attention in the wild, animals have developed a number of techniques. But to stand out in business, all you have to do is go to PC World or any software store for your free Adobe Action Pack. Adobe is the professional choice for page layout, illustration, and image editing software. So make it your choice too. Action Pack gets you up to speed fast, and it's free when you buy any copy of Adobe Illustrator, PageMaker, or Photoshop. Offer valid until December 31st while stocks last. Mrs. Wilson, you have 30 seconds to remember all the gift items you saw at Fish Brothers, starting from the...
Rotary watches,
yes.
Secondus, watch, Gucci, Tag.
Yes, there's 9 brands in all. Keep going.
Royal Doulton and Labro China.
Yes.
Glassware, clocks, figurines, silverware.
You've got 10 seconds left. Keep going.
Crystal, gold and silver earrings.
Gold and silver earrings. Fabulous.
Did I mention you and second-hand jewellery?
You have now, Mrs. Wilson.
Fish Brothers Jewellers, throughout North East London, Essex, and now south of the river at FT Gentleman on the Walworth Road.
Oh, and the cuddly toy.
That's the manager, Mrs. Wilson.
20 years after her death, her music lives on. Maria Callas, the voice of the century. Discover why she is missed by so many on this, the ultimate collection. The greatest diva of them all, Maria Callas, the voice of the century. Coming up in the next hour, LBC Finance with Business Link London. All the answers you need to help a business grow.
6:15, the main story so far this afternoon. NHS reforms brought in by the Conservatives are being rolled back. The government, in the Commons this afternoon, has announced a new 10-year plan which will scrap GP fund holding. Jules Wilson has the travel.
Well, all lanes are now open on the M25 after an earlier accident clockwise between junction 16 for the M40 and 17 for Rickmansworth, but there are big delays clockwise back to junction 12. And the Mall in Westminster is now open eastbound after an earlier accident. Again, those delays will take some time to clear. And as a result, Birdcage Walk in Westminster is very heavy eastbound, heading towards Parliament Square. Park Farm Road in Upminster is closed with an accident between Berwick Pond Road and Harwood Hall Lane, and it's a slog for South Circular drivers at Kew Bridge. You're stacked up northbound from Mortlake Road towards a very busy Chiswick roundabout. If you're travelling the tubes this evening with signal failure at Wanstead, there are delays on the Central Line. London Travel News every 15 minutes at drive time on LBC 1152.
With over 250 shops nationwide, the word is Vodafone.
Coming up in the next hour, LBC Finance with Business Link London. All the answers you need to help a business grow.
16 minutes past 6 is the time, and my guest is James Geary, editor of the Special Discovery edition of Time magazine. And I didn't think it would belong, James, before Darwin came into the conversation. And indeed, you've got the evolution of evolution. The latest applications of Darwinian theory could explain why boys will be boys, and how we select mates, and why we like hamburgers. This is, I suppose, all about human nature, isn't it?
That's right. It's, according to the new Darwinians, there is a human nature, which many people have doubted in the past, and it is universal. And it basically involves applying Darwin's theory of natural selection to certain aspects of human behavior that in the past were considered purely psychological or purely cultural. They now seem to have genetic and or biological basis.
Yes, and we always say, don't we, human nature being what it is, and go on to say something about that. So there is something to all this.
Yes, and human nature being what it is, we like hamburgers, and there is a Darwinian explanation for that, as you indicated. And, for example, why boys will be boys, according to this type of Darwinian theory, there is a reason why men prefer certain types of women for their mates. And normally it's people think, well, that is a cultural that is specific to a certain culture, whether women are plump or thin or tall or short. But according to the Darwinians, that there is a hip waist ratio that is universally consistent. So then that's to say that the hips are 70% of the size of the waist, and whether the woman is plump or rail thin, that hip to waist ratio remains constant throughout all cultures and all times.
And obviously a difference in the bodies, but difference in the psychologies as well.
Yes, indeed, and certainly in the sex is obviously an important issue for Darwinian theory, and the psychology of sex, why men prefer many mates and why women tend to prefer fewer mates is because they biologically have to do all the work in bringing up the children. So promiscuity is not in their biological interest. It just means more work for them, basically, while males of the species are not necessarily obligated to take care of their offspring.
Well, I suppose if you give a man 50 wives, he could have children galore, but a woman with 50 husbands found it rather difficult.
That's quite a different scenario, yes.
Okay, let's move on to the third item, which is indeed the third wave. Now, you say here computers will soon be disappearing from the desktop and entering our daily lives. How will they be doing that?
Well, this is a new, relatively recent program of research initiated in the United States called ubiquitous computing, which basically means that computers will be gradually disappearing from the desktop and entering things, ordinary things around the house. For example, you could have a computer in your coffee cup, which can inform your coffee machine that you've either finished your coffee in the morning, or alternatively that your coffee has gotten cold and that the coffee machine should brew a new pot.
Good gracious me.
And this is based on advances in computer technology, which are allowing more and more computing power to be squeezed into fewer and fewer and smaller chips. So you wouldn't have a complete computer inside your coffee cup. You'd have a few silicon chips, which would be designed to carry out specific tasks. And these could range from something as practical as the brewing coffee to having your coffee machine actually play your favorite music. If you like to hear Tchaikovsky in the morning, as soon as your coffee machine receives instructions from your coffee cup at 7 a.m. to brew the first pot of coffee,
yeah,
Tchaikovsky's could filter in through your house
and
without you having to lift a finger.
So on Monday, it could play Tchaikovsky, and if you felt a little bit in a different mood on Tuesday, it could play something about the Beatles, could it?
That's exactly right. And you would be relieved of the chore of having to do that all yourself, to program your VCR or program your CD player to respond to your requests.
Aren't we in danger of being pandered to almost to the nth degree? I mean, things are going to become so easy, aren't they?
Well, that's a very, I think that's a very good question, and that's, in fact, one of the researchers who initiated this ubiquitous computing is a man named Mark Weiser in America, and he addresses just that point in one of the articles in this issue, and he admits that, for example, any advance in technology, whether it be with computers or the stone axe or the automobile, necessarily means the loss of a certain skill. For example, automobiles are now so complicated that very few people can repair them alone. You have to go to a specialist.
Yes.
And so the art of automobile repair has been lost. But Mark Weiser argues that while specialists, automobile repair specialists remain, other people are freed of having to learn that or retain that type of knowledge, and they're free to learn other things and explore new areas. So you could see it as a dumbing down of the population, which is a very real risk, but it also is an opportunity to explore new areas.
How far are we off that, do you think?
How far are we from?
Yeah, from, well, say, the coffee percolator playing Tchaikovsky.
That exists. That exists.
Does it really?
Yes. And all the things I should point out in the Discovery issue, and certainly for this special section on computer technology, they all exist. They're here today. So this is not science fiction, and it's not 10 or 15 or 50 years down the road.
No.
The computerized coffee maker exists. and I think it'll be 5 to 10 years before it's available, you know, just as a CD player is today.
Yeah. Now, that brings us on to computers, which are being researched at the moment to talk and restore sight to the blind.
Yes, and these, again, these...
Do these exist?
They do. It sounds like a miraculous claim that a computer can restore sight to the blind, but it can, and it does.
How does it do it? I mean, can you explain in a couple of minutes, or is it so complicated?
No, I hope I can explain it in a couple of minutes.
Yeah?
For example, the thing that the computer can restore sight is retinal display. And basically what it is a high-tech pair of eyeglasses that a person wears, and inside the eyeglasses, the eyeglasses are connected to a computer, and inside the eyeglasses is a very elaborate set of lasers, and the computer can create images and through these lasers project the images directly onto a person's retina, which is it's a little sheet of the light-sensitive cells at the back of the eye.
Yes.
And basically what it is the equivalent of having a movie projector. Instead of having a movie projector project an image onto a white screen, the virtual retinal display is the movie projector that projects the image directly onto your retina, so that there's no screen in between the projector and the image that you receive.
And does this work for people who are completely blind?
Well,
or do you have to have some form of partial sight to take advantage of this?
It would not work if your retina was completely either absent or completely damaged to such an extent that it didn't work anymore.
Oh, the muscles were dead or whatever.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. But there is, in fact, this is how it was an accident that they realized that the VRD could do this. As someone came in to the laboratory in Oregon where this is being done,
mm-hmm.
and he happened to gaze into this into these glasses, and he suddenly could see in I think it was his left eye, in which he had been blind for several years since he had a car accident. And what happened was the retina had been covered with some scar tissue, which prevented light from passing through to hit the retina, so he was effectively blind. But the VRD, the very powerful lasers that it uses, went through the scar tissue and went through the little gaps in the scar tissue and reached his retina, so that he could see an image produced by the VRD, whereas with that eye he could see nothing in the real world, for example.
James, one last item, and I must ask you to be brief about this, if you can, but the start of a new frontier, says the article, or the end of the road. Discovery is only just beginning.
Well, that depends on who you ask. these are the last two articles in the issue, and
mm-hmm.
Sir John Maddox, the editor emeritus of Nature, he argues that science is actually very much closer to its beginnings than to its ends. And John Horgan, an American science writer, takes the view that discovery is basically over. All the big discoveries have already been made,
yes.
And that we'll never have a cure for cancer, for example. We'll never have warp drive spaceships as in Star Trek and things like that.
But here we are, you see, with computers which can aid the blind. But you'll say, won't you, in answer to that, that that's already on the market, or it will be.
Well, 10 or 15 years ago, I think very few people could have imagined a computer that could restore sight to people.
So do you agree with Sir John?
I tend to agree with Sir John that discovery is actually just beginning. And I think the discovery issue is in a way, proof of that, because in virtually all fields of human endeavor, there are still amazing things being discovered. And with each discovery is a new question and a new problem, which leads to a new area of investigation and eventually new discoveries.
And of course I won't quote you, but it's an impossible question perhaps, or maybe it isn't for you, but will we ever have a cure for cancer? Is it possible?
that is a very difficult
question. It is, I'm sure it is.
It is possible, but I don't think it's on the immediate horizon.
No. What are the developments, the discoveries that we might look for in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think to stick with human health, the research that's going on in the Human Genome Project, which is essentially mapping out all the genes in the human body and trying to identify precisely their function and how they work to either maintain health or cause disease, I think there'll be very interesting developments with gene therapy, which is basically introducing new genes into the human body to correct the faults of damaged or faulty genes, for example, and that is a potential treatment for cancer. It's not a cure, but it's a potential treatment. And one example is people are now investigating the genes which control growth. For example, every fetus yes. has to grow all its limbs and all its organs and things like that. And people are thinking, well, wouldn't it be great if we could just, if someone needed a heart transplant, if we could just grow a heart in the laboratory somewhere instead of having to wait for a potential donor?
James, it's been fascinating talking to you. We must do it again sometime. 20 minutes seems all too short a time for the voyage of discovery that we've been through. But thank you very much indeed. James Geary is editor of this special discovery edition of Time, and a really good read it is, although I've just flipped through the pages myself.